You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, county fairs have been canceled around the state. Farm reporter Pam Yonke joins the show for a look at the impact of local fairs and what they mean for communities. Right now, we're starting a conversation about a mother's worry for her son. We start with this piece from Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen.
There are parents in Wisconsin who fear for the future of their black sons. That's no different for storyteller Tequila Benton of Madison, who wishes others would see her son as they see their own children. She shared this story live in 2014. It contains language that may be offensive to listeners.
Last night, I held my son while he slept. I couldn't bear to put him into his own bed. I squeezed him tightly and tried not to cry too loudly as I kissed his caramel-colored forehead. My silly, adorable little guy. Like all little boys his age, he's obsessed with Minecraft and superheroes. His default speed is somehow turbo all the time. And any sound produced by a bodily function induces uncontrollable laughter. He sings when he's in a good mood, and once told me that fried cheese curds are so delicious, they should be Madison's official food. He's got a knack for annoying his older sister, and if I let him every day and to bed, he would wear a suit and full tie. And I'm terrified for his life. Not the normal maternal worry about chipped teeth, scraped knees, and sports-related injuries. No. I harbor deep-seated anxiety and gut-wrenching fear for the statistically inevitable outcome of his future, imprisonment or death. Some days I'm emotionally catatonic because I don't have enough courage. I don't have enough courage to raise a black man. I tell myself he'll be different. I'll raise him better. I'll learn from other mothers' mistakes and give him every opportunity for success. But I know nothing that I do, nothing I teach him, no opportunity awarded or future I map out for him, not a damn thing can guarantee that he will live a long life free of handcuffs or a coffin. In a society where he doesn't have any value unless he's holding a ball or a mic, this sweet little boy who loves karate, I try to teach him to work hard now so you can play harder later. Make decisions that you can be proud of. Speak up now, don't mumble. Say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, to everyone. Hold the door for women and elderly folk. Tell the truth and keep your promises. My promise is to keep you safe and try my best to protect you from the hate. Don't be late. Keep your hands out of your pocket. Smile, be polite, but don't let people push you around. Always stay in control of your emotions. I know, it's not fair that you get in trouble at school for doing the same thing the little boy did, but your actions are different. You're different. You always will be. It's not fair, but you have to be better than everyone else because you get noticed more. Say please and thank you, don't sag your pants, or hang out with folks that make bad decisions. Just because that song is popular and everybody is singing it, I do not want to hear you saying it. Speak proper English. Who cares if they say you talk white? That enunciation and use of verbs may one day save your life. What good will any of this do if he's deemed a thug or threat? Punished more severely for the same mistakes. Can I really protect him, my dimple little cheek guy, from all the hate? How do I teach him to value his life in a society where his life seems so valueless? How do I teach him individuality and to be accountable for his actions when his mere presence evokes the stereotypical mass panic and paranoia that pushes the plague of imprisonment and poaching of black men into extinction? Perhaps the ASPCA should protect our black men instead of the NAACP. I tried to explain the pain to a 7-year-old, the movement behind Black Lives Matter, teach him that he matters, and so do so many others that we'll never know. because in their veins flow the perseverance and power of those dauntless ancestors who endure the torture and turbulent times, sacrificing their lives and enduring pain so that it would not be mine or his. I teach him to honor the sacrifices that others made for future generations of Black kids that they'll never know. I want to teach my quirky little guy who loves Doctor Who individuality and pride, but his survival may very well depend on how well he is able to hide. His manhood, see, the idea of a Black man that is non-threatening, who isn't viewed as a thug or a nigger, is a lie. I want to protect my funny, sweet, adorable little guy, but the powerlessness dwindles my hopes for humanity. For his tiny shoulders, all of this may be too heavy. I just want everyone to always see him the way I do and take care of him like he is their son, too. To see him with all the pride and promise, not the stereotypes and lies. I want to hold him and protect him from the world because the thought of holding his dead body and having to bury him in a suit and tie he loves so much causes my soul to splinter and bleed through my pores. I just can't watch the news anymore. I will just sit here with him and hold my little guy for all the Black mothers who too soon had to say goodbye. Thank you.
Tequila Benton's story came to us from the podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. She's the co-host of the podcast and originally shared the story in 2014 at a Listen to Your Mother event. I feel constantly right. If life is fair, Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
This is Central Time. Next up, we're talking with Tequila Benton about what's happened in these past 6 years. Our conversation is just ahead here on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We just heard a story that Tequila Benton told 6 years ago about her worries for her son. She's a mother, transformative healer, writer, activist, and lover of all things Black. She says that she wants the world to understand love matters and Black lives matter always. She joins us now, Tequila, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on today.
We just heard your story about, as you put it, your sweet little boy and your fear. What's changed?
Not very much. I mean, he's a much bigger, sweet little boy. He's taller than me now, and he's facing the world, kind of navigating his own way through. So it's more in-depth conversations and him exploring his personality and the world around him. And so we're just trying to find our way through that.
How did you change the way you talked to him from when he was a fan of Minecraft and superheroes until now? I mean, those things may still be true, but right, he's a different, older person.
Right. The language, just like I said, has gotten more frank and, to be honest, transparent, as social media is a bigger thing in his life. He's able to view some of these things that I was able to shield him from when he was younger. So he has his own questions and his own analysis of what things should be and how things really went down. So, you know, there's definitely some more grown up conversations going on. And Minecraft has switched to Fortnite, like most kids. So, I mean, superheroes are still a thing in the house. So same kind of conversations go on.
Yeah. What led you to share that very personal story about your fears those 6 years ago?
That was around the time I believe Trayvon Martin had got killed, and it was all over the news, as well as some other incidents of similar tragedy. And so working with Listen to Your Mother, I just needed to kind of get it out. And so I had already been working on little tips for him here and there on sticky notes and on my phone, just things that to remember to talk to him about as he gets older, or stories I've heard from other mothers, just things I wanted to say to him. So I kind of compiled as much as I could into a audience-friendly story, and just kind of wanted to tell that story. And in fact, I still actually add to that poem even to this day as things continue to occur in the world.
You add to the poem. It just extends. Mm-hmm.
It just continues to go on and on.
What kind of response did you get from people?
It was a very warm welcome. A lot of folks in the audience, and actually my son was in the audience that day, hugged him and me and kind of expressed their regret and sorrow and things that they wanted to do differently going forward after hearing the piece. It's been shared a whole lot around, and it's also been things that I was able to discuss not only with Langston, but also with, officials at his school or other parents who had similar worries and they just didn't know how to voice their concern, or they thought it was just them. And so it opened up a lot of dialogue, more so for people who don't have kids of color and haven't really thought about those are the tragedies we have to face when we parent and all the obstacles that we have that they don't even consider for their own kids.
And how important is that perspective now that we're living in a time where there's this important and long overdue conversation about race happening?
It's vital right now, especially for them to be open and transparent. A friend of mine said to me the other day that as a Black man, it's a super struggle because, you know, you could be killed in your house. You could be killed jogging, traffic stop in a Walmart. And it's kind of like, well, what do they want from me? Do they want me to live or do they want my life? So just for them to understand, and these are people around the world, just, you know, that there's humanity that's being lost. And so those conversations need to be had about how desensitized we are to the murders of Black people in America and how we just somehow need to find some understanding and have these conversations without feelings being involved that shut all conversation down.
Tequila Benton is here sharing her story. She's co-host of the Inside Stories podcast. And I want to also welcome Jen Rubin now. Jen co-produces the Moth Story Slam in Madison and is the author of We Are Staying, 80 Years in the Life of a Family, a Store, and a Neighborhood. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've helped hundreds of people tell their own stories, whether through the Moth Story Slam or workshops that you teach. Why is that a passion for you?
I think that storytelling has a way of amplifying voices and can lower fences in our community. And so one of the things, you know, when Tequila and I came up with this idea of doing Inside Stories podcast is that, you know, there's just a variety of life stories across Madison. And if we could share them, it has the potential to deepen connections kind of within and between communities. And so that's kind of the idea behind sharing other people's stories.
And you also told the story of your own family and its business in your book. How does your experience shape encouraging other people to be brave and talk about the things in their life?
I think we all have so many stories within us. And so, you know, figuring out how to tell the story the way you want to tell it. And what I like to spend time with when I, you know, do workshops or talk with people is how do you sort of share the context around the story? You know, Tequila's story, if we didn't understand the context of what's happening with, you know, how many Black men are being killed by cops, like, you know, without understanding that context, you know, then the story isn't as powerful. Can I say something about Tequila's story? Is that all right?
Absolutely.
So one thing, you know, I think for people listening who haven't thought a lot about sort of the care and craft that it takes to tell as impactful a story as Tequila's told. You know, lots of people have wanted to hear her story. And she and I talked about this in our podcast, that she very much crafted it with a white audience in mind. So we can feel the pain and anxiety of Black parents sending their Black sons out into the world, knowing the world might see them with suspicion. So the way she started it with the shared humanity of experiences of all young boys, so for the white audience can think, oh, my kid is like that, my grandkid is like that. But then she pivots to how it's different for Black parents. I just think there's just a lot of craft that she put into that to make it such an impactful story.
Yeah.
Well, oh, Tequila. Thank you, Jen.
You're welcome, Tequila.
Share the love. Tequila, I think there's something to that, though, that's striking for me, too, because you don't have to explain that experience to other Black parents of Black children. They know it. So when you were doing this, you were thinking about trying to teach white people?
Exactly. Jen is exactly right. Yep. Because most of the audience at the Listen to Your Mother show were definitely not people of color. And so I didn't want to specifically tailor it from my experience. I needed to connect. And that's the central theme of story, is finding those threads to connect us all so that we all kind of are along for the ride on the emotion that's in your story. And we feel it from your perspective. And that's the hugest impact that story can make, is just to connect us and make me feel what you feel, and vice versa.
How do you balance, though, the idea that you shouldn't have to teach other people about your default existence with wanting them to know and wanting them to understand?
There honestly is no balance. The reality is that's where we are. Like I said, there's a disconnect between understanding the humanity and the struggle of Black people. And so just knowing that that is a reality is really more of getting to a point where I can understand others to help them understand me. And just approaching it from that perspective and just doing the best that I can to use the words and to craft the story and emotion to kind of touch you in a place where I can't help but to keep your attention until my very last word.
You two co-host the Inside Stories podcast. Tequila, where did this come from? What's it about?
Well, Inside Stories, as Jen said, kind of explores Madison one story at a time via the live storytelling venues we have here, which obviously are going on right now. So we've taken it to kind of accepting stories and doing it from our homes. But we just wanted to sit down with the storytellers and just what Jen did, kind of deconstruct the story and how it's done and why, and ask them more in-depth questions about, you know, why did you use that scenario or these emotions, and break down story for those who are interested in telling their own story so they can kind of get a little bit of education and entertainment.
And what kind of storytellers do you talk with, Tequila?
All different types. Ones who've done stories at the Odyssey workshops Jen and I co-facilitate, as well as The Moth or Listen to Your Mother. So they range from stories about a vet to stories about a Black man being a teacher, or someone surviving the Holocaust, or children's dying, or, you know, someone coming out. It's just a variety of amazing stories that we get. We're super lucky to have those.
Jen,
sorry.
No, please go ahead.
So we share the stories that we think are some of the greater stories that we've heard. And I think part of what makes a story really stick with people and resonate is, even if it's not your experience, there's some sort of universal thread to the story. So even if you didn't visit a sibling in prison, or you didn't cross the Mexican border, or you didn't have a child who died of cancer, there's something about how they put together the story that it really speaks to people, both because they're interested in that story, but they can see something of themselves in that story. And so we really make a point of bringing in the stories that we feel like does that and sort of gives people a lot to think about.
And Jen, what if someone wants to share their story, but they really don't know how to go to about it? Where do you encourage them to start?
Well, they could contact us at Inside Stories Podcast at gmail.com, because we're often doing workshops. But, you know, workshops are super helpful. You know, if you're in the Milwaukee area, Exfabula does a lot of workshops. I'm sure in other parts of the state, people are doing workshops. And that just really helps you figure out, well, what story do I want to tell? And then how do I want to tell it? Because that's, I mean, I hear that at The Moth all the time, where people really want to tell a story, but they're afraid to do it. And so taking a workshop or reading about, you know, what's a good element to telling a story, is just useful.
And Tequila, what would you say to someone who doesn't think that their life or their story is worth telling?
Oh, every story is worth telling. Every experience is. Just write it down, get it out of you, and tell it to someone that's safe, even if it's your cat or dog. I mean, just get it out of you. And once you honestly tell it on stage, and I know Jen has this experience too, is most folks are like, okay, I need to do that again. So, like, that is so freeing and cathartic when you are able to tell your story and get acceptance from people you never thought would have understood or connected or accepted it. So just get it out and email us and we can help you with it, like Jen said.
Yeah. Where do you find the bravery to take that first step and get it out, though?
Put a pen and a piece of paper together and just start writing. There's the bravery right there.
Yeah. Jen, mm-hmm. I think sometimes we can be concerned about how other people will view our stories. Obviously, we want to connect with people. We want them to understand the validity of our stories. That might not be how everyone receives it. How do we break through that fear?
Well, I think it depends upon, you know, are you putting together a story that you're going to tell like in front of a room of strangers, or are you putting together a story because, you know, you want to tell a good story to your friends? Like, it sort of depends upon what I will say. I've never been in a storytelling audience where everyone is not on your side. I mean, it's sort of yours to lose, you know, to have an audience, to have people not be on your side, because I know just what kind of bravery it takes to get up there the first time. I will say, like, if you're practicing a story and you feel very nervous about the story, then it probably means you haven't yet put it together how you want it. So I would just keep thinking about it, keep working on it, you know, get feedback from a friend.
Oh, interesting. So you're saying that when we get there with the stories we want to tell, even though there may be some, you know, nerves about going in front of people or something like that, if we have anxiety, there may be something to it that we could rearrange or adjust or include differently that could make it more comfortable for us.
I mean, that's my experience. Like, I always practice saying it out loud. And if I get to something where I'm like, I'm having a hard time saying this, then maybe I'm just not ready to say it, you know, or I'm not saying it the way I want to say it.
Sure. I want to thank Jen. We really appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having us.
And Tequila, thanks for your willingness to share your story.
Thank you so much for sharing the story with me.
We've got Tequila Benton and Jen Rubin here, who co-host the Inside Stories podcast. Tequila is a mother, a transformative healer, a writer, activist, and lover of all things Black. And Jen Rubin wrote, "We are staying 80 years in the life of a family, a store, in a neighborhood, and a neighborhood." And we've been talking with them about storytelling and the importance of the bravery to begin, get it done, and tell your stories, because they're all important. Coming up, summer is the season for midway rides and all the food on the stick that you can think of, but many are choosing to cancel or postpone those fairs this season. We're talking about the value of county fairs for their communities, and we want to hear your fair memories. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you remember, what's special about it, what's important to you. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, we're talking about school resource officers. Hear from the president of the Milwaukee Board of School Directors and from a crime prevention specialist, and whether we should continue having cops in schools. That's tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Now, while more than half of Wisconsin's county fairs have made moves to cancel, postpone, or change format this year, we still have plenty of past experience to remember what makes a Wisconsin county fair so special. For many counties across the state, the local fair is the event of the season, a place where you meet up with friends and family, walk around sweating in the hot summer sun, eat some cotton candy, hang out in the animal barns. It's tradition. You might even say county fairs are a part of a place's identity. We're talking about it with Pam Yonke. She's the farm director for the Midwest Farm Report Radio Network. Her reporting and podcasts can be found at MidwestFarmReport.com. And she's been involved in fairs personally and professionally for much of her life, including as a dairy exhibitor in county fairs and reigning as Oconto County's Dairy Queen. Pam, thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure, Keely.
It's an understatement to say you've spent a lot of time visiting fairs across the state, right?
Yeah, pretty much. When you're a farm kid, that's what you do. And to your point, that's the highlight for a lot of kids in the summer months, getting everything ready for exhibit at the county fair, which starts with a lot of kids that are involved in more intricate projects or livestock. They've been working on these projects since well before COVID-19. So they've invested a lot of time and money even before any of the fair decisions were made. And I can sympathize with them. You know, your summer definitely deflates a little bit when you find out you're not going to get those opportunities.
Yeah. What are some of the first things that come to your mind when we're talking about these events, these rituals in communities?
Yeah, for me, it was always, you know, the buddies that you were going to see in the barns. I exhibited dairy. That was primarily where I was focused. All my buddies were in the livestock project. So being able to see people that you only see once a year was probably the bigger highlight. I was always very involved in my county fair. So a lot of the adult leaders, you look forward to seeing them. I was very involved in 4-H with as a leader, as leadership responsibilities myself. So I was in the ring announcing. I was in the ring showing my animals. I was in the barns helping other kids get ready with their livestock. So it was that camaraderie that I really looked forward to. You know, let's face it, if you're not so much now because everybody's connected, but if you're a kid out in the country and you haven't seen your buddies at school for a couple of months, you haven't been really doing anything socially with your buddies for a couple months, that county fair opportunity to get back together with your buddies was pretty important, pretty special, and really looked forward to, aside from the fact that it just felt good to kind of put a crescendo on your exhibits and finally get that all done, too.
Pam Yonke's been involved in fairs for much of her life, and we're talking about local fairs here on Central Time. You're part of our conversation. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Have county fairs been a part of your summer traditions? What part of the fair do you enjoy the most? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your fair memories, if you're a 4-H member or a leader, and what the county fair means to you. 800-642-1234. Pam, let's talk more about 4-H, because that's a part of the fair that some people know really well and others don't fully understand. Why is the fair so important to 4-H youth?
You know, I think sometimes people get a little tunnel vision on what Wisconsin 4-H is all about. I think they think about the livestock, and of course, that's one of my passions, but there's an awful lot of things that 4-H offers young people that can be seen at a county fair. Everything from poster works that show about maybe something veterinary care that they're interested in. They've got rocket science. There's all the food and prep work that kids can get involved in, from baking and cookies and things like that. Then there's the sewing aspect that a lot of kids still are really involved with. There's so many different things that Wisconsin 4-H offers kids to do, and that's actually something that I've been talking about on the air as well. You know, county fairs are one thing that we're missing out for young people's activities. 4-H camp was another ritual that we used to go through when we were kids. So there's a lot of things that 4-H offers young people, but unfortunately this year it's going to have to take a different look, or it's not going to be able to be offered at all. So that is what I think a lot of people see. Almost every exhibit that you see at a fair has some connection to 4-H in some way, shape, or form. Now, I don't want to overlook the other elements, the other associations that are involved in allowing youth to be at a fair. We've got many fairs that have a lot of strong affiliations with the FFA. So you see them, those chapters exhibiting as well around the county fair. There are some groups that are also involved with Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, different things like that. So it's not just 4-H, but in my experience, 4-H makes up the majority of the youth exhibitors that you're going to see at the fair. And remember, it's not just an individual thing when it comes to 4-H. You are with your club. You are with a group of other kids. Maybe, you know, one thing we always did, you got to work the 4-H food stand. And as silly as it may seem to some people that have never had that experience, I literally remember changing clothes from showing my dairy animals and hightailing it over to the 4-H food stand, because that was a genuine fundraiser for a lot of county fair activities or fair activities through the calendar year. And again, that's not something a lot of kids get to do every day. So it was a little different. You got to work with a different group of adults in the food stand. You obviously got a chance to interact with the public and maybe see people you wouldn't have otherwise seen. So there are many layers to a county fair. And I'm sure the people that you've asked to call in or email or what have you, you probably had those same kinds of silly little experiences that may touch your heart now. But a lot of people, like I said, if all you're doing is coming out for the food and the rides, you're really missing some of the most critical, heartwarming elements of any county fair, regardless of where it is.
And if you are going for the food and the rides, you might stumble upon some of these other things that are happening that you've never been a part of or never knew about before. You just have to take the time to check them out.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, I appreciate county fair as much as the food as much as anybody. And, of course, a lot of county fairs, that is a fundraising element for a lot of community associations and organizations. It's just that when I hear that people are only going to an event, you know, a lot of people at the that go to the Wisconsin State Fair only know about the entertainment, the food, and the rides. And that's where I get a little concerned that you're missing so much more of what a fair has to offer. But to your point, Keely, all you have to do is take the time. And there's a lot of kids that are in have invested all their time and energy in those projects. They would love to have a conversation with someone that's curious about what they did, how they did it, and what they plan to do with it for the future.
Yeah, time and energy in those projects, and especially when it comes to bringing animals, that's almost a summer job in a way. There is sometimes a financial loss here with county fairs not happening.
Well, we're a little concerned about that, and I've seen a lot of county fairs and the parents and the associations mobilize since these decisions have been made. You're right. There is a true financial investment that the young people and their families have made in the livestock, in the feed, in all the care, in all the energy and time that you put into working with that animal. And now suddenly you're not really left with many options on what you're going to do with the animals. Now, if you're on a farm, you know that that animal can stick around with the rest of the herd, or you can also think about marketing it through one of our traditional livestock markets. Those are all avenues out there. But again, I think what many kids look forward to is the interaction, the excitement, the adrenaline when they get in the center of a ring and the auctioneer is helping them sell their animals. A lot of kids that I've worked with, that's a memory they'll never forget, and they're using those monies not only to repay their parents a little bit on the investment, but they're also using it for college education and for investment perhaps in the projects in the next year. And let's face it, Keely, with the way that our agriculture economy in Wisconsin has been absolutely rocked to its foundation because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the gyrations in food distribution and consumer buying patterns, that's kind of a big deal this year. Nobody can afford to take a financial hit on a project that was otherwise not only supposed to be educational and rewarding, personally, it was also at least supposed to have a little bit of a payback on the investment.
We're talking with Pam Yonke, who's the farm director for the Midwest Farm Report Radio Network. She's been involved in fairs professionally and personally much of her life, including as a dairy exhibitor in county fairs. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Share your fair experiences today. What lessons did you learn? Were you part of 4-H or FFA? Did you go to county fairs all the time? Maybe you did go for the food and the rides, but you discovered other things. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with Pam Yonke. She's a reporter and podcaster at MidwestFarmReport.com. She spent many years covering and participating in county fairs herself. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. We're taking your calls about your memories, your experiences at county fairs, as many have had to decide not to happen this year, to cancel. And we've got Steve from Antioch, Illinois on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What are you remembering?
My dad used to go to the county fairs all the time. He was in 4-H, and that was really important to him, you know, when he was a kid, showing his animals and things like that. And ever since then, our family's been going to county fairs. I've been to probably 20 Wisconsin state fairs. And then I also wanted to put a shout out to Vilas County Fair in Eagle River. We go there all the time.
So lots of memories there, Steve. Thank you for sharing those. And Pam, you can hear Steve even talking about how his father's experience transferred from one generation to the next, because you can just hear in Steve's voice how much it mattered to his dad.
Right. And it really is a family kind of situation. There's a lot of parents that I see now, and I've been doing this for so long, Keely, like I said, from the time I was on the farm through when I was in college and now as a farm broadcaster. And if people go to my Facebook page, Fabulous Farm Babe, you'll see how busy our staff has been, not this year, obviously, but last year with all our fair coverage. And what you notice is it's a generational thing. It really is. And it's not just about the exhibitors. It's generational in all of the volunteers that make county fairs work. It may be about the people that are in the food stands. It might be about vendors that show up. It might be about the buyers that are there every year to support those kids with their livestock or animal projects. It's also about the volunteers that make up the fair boards that have to try to keep things running 365 days a year to have it all organized and ready when the fair is on. So there's a generational thing that I notice. If your parents showed, chances are if you still have the opportunity, you will show. I know a lot of families that are at least three, four generations deep exhibiting at the same county fair, at the same livestock shows, at the same different events. And like I said, it's families to families. It's not just individuals. It's a lot of families to families. And more I see today, there's also situations where kids maybe don't, they're not maybe on the farm anymore, but they still have that desire to be involved. There's a lot of mentorships that go on with our fairs today, where a family may say, okay, you can have the animal stay at our place. You come out and you feed it, you help take care of it, you get it ready for the fair, we'll house it and help you that way. A lot of those kinds of mentorships, partnerships are a part of our fairs today. So again, it is about families. It's about connecting. It's about the culture and the generational impact that fairs have across the state.
Yeah, the building of community. I mean, many of the fairs around Wisconsin won't be happening this year. Some will, but either virtually or in person, without things certainly like the way they used to be. So instead of feeling disappointed or angry, Pam, how are we going to look on the bright side here?
Well, you know, I think there's still a lot of opportunity for communities to come together. I mentioned that there are a lot of little satellite projects that are still happening. Lafayette County Fair, Fond du Lac County Fair, they're still going forward with kind of a stripped down event right now to still allow kids that opportunity to display their work, you know, show their animals and do things like that. It just won't necessarily involve a carnival or outside vendors. So they're doing their best to try to continue to keep people connected with their community. And, you know, then the other thing is a lot of groups are also just trying to do individual events, like maybe an evening where they are still going to have the kids that were in the Youth Livestock Project come together. They're going around to local businesses and gathering money that maybe will allow them to at least offer the kids some kind of financial compensation for their animals. Logistics are really what are still being worked out for a lot of counties. But, you know, the thing is, when those fairs made the decision, if they did, that they couldn't go forward in 2021, you have to respect how difficult a decision that was, because those people are connected to their community. But they also have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that if they're going to do something, it's with respect to the safety of the community, and it's also with respect to the financial obligations that the fair would have. A lot of these fairs are in precarious position as far as their checkbook is concerned. You can't afford to make a mistake once because it could definitely sabotage the event for the future. It's been a very difficult decision for every county fair out there. But again, like I said, keep checking back with your county fairs and see what other alternate ideas or opportunities they're providing, not only for the kids, but for you too.
All right, Pam, we won't give up just quite yet. Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Keely. Thank you.
Pam Yonke is the farm director for the Midwest Farm Report Radio Network. Her reporting and podcast can be found at MidwestFarmReport.com. She's been involved in fairs personally and professionally much of her life, and that includes being a dairy exhibitor in county fairs, and she was also Oconto County's Dairy Queen. And she joined us to talk about the value of county fairs to communities across our state. Because of the new coronavirus pandemic, healthcare professionals have tried to limit the number of patients coming into medical facilities. But sometimes care just can't wait. Corrine Hess reports on how cancer patients are weighing treatment against possibly contracting the virus.
During routine gallbladder surgery 6 years ago, Diane Smetana's doctor noticed several tumors on her colon. He removed them, and when she woke up from the procedure, Smetana was told she had stage 4 colon cancer.
My family was all standing around me, and I'm like, I don't think this is going to be good news. But then he said, you have cancer, and he says, I have good news and bad news. The good news is, I can deal with that one. And the bad news is, then you have another kind of cancer in the colon.
Over the next 6 years, the 74-year-old Burlington resident would fight and pray and lie with her grandchildren and watch movies after invasive chemotherapy treatments. But what started as colon cancer metastasized to uterine, liver, and brain cancer. Smetana wanted to give up, but her doctor recommended she try immunotherapy, which uses the patient's immune system to fight the disease. Smetana goes to Frederick Hospital every 3 weeks for her treatment. And so far, it's working.
I just had number 33, and I had a scan last week, and I went in, and he's just like, the scan is beautiful.
Smetana went for treatment at the end of February, just as the country was beginning to recognize the new coronavirus as a pandemic. She says she never considered not continuing her cancer care, but worried she might not be able to be treated.
I thought, what if they can't have me? What if they're not giving the treatments right now? What if this place is like closed up for a while? I just kept saying, what if?
Dr. Jim Thomas heads solid tumor oncology at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin's Clinical Cancer Center. He's also Smetana's doctor. Thomas says cancer patients generally have worse outcomes if they get COVID-19, but he says oftentimes treatment can't wait.
People with active cancer, they have a known, deadly disease, and it can't take a holiday, it can't take a rest, it can't take a vacation. That we have to keep going with their treatment, we have to keep going with their therapy, we have to keep taking care of them.
But not everyone can continue. Jennifer Jindrick lives in Madison and has stage 4 colon cancer that has metastasized to her lungs. Jindrick was diagnosed 3 years ago when she was 44 years old.
My mom had colon cancer at 54, so you go in 10 years before, and it had already metastasized.
She was given an 11% chance of being alive in 5 years.
So the fact that I'm doing okay at 3 years is really good.
Every 2 weeks, Jindrick has a 3.5-hour infusion of chemotherapy for maintenance. But in March, her husband was diagnosed with COVID-19 and hospitalized. Jindrich's doctors wanted to keep her away from the hospital, so she missed a month of treatment.
And since then, I've been coughing more, which is kind of a sign that things are growing.
Dr. Noelle Locante is an oncologist at the University of Wisconsin's Carbone Cancer Center. She says for some of the sickest cancer patients, the idea of contracting coronavirus is too much to take, and they decide it's time to stop fighting. Locante says she supports her patients' decisions, but she feels like they have their backs up against the wall.
Do you want to increase your risk of a really bad outcome from a virus, or do you want to die sooner? It's a terrible, terrible choice.
Locante says doctors have been trying to make sure patients who are getting chemotherapy after surgery continue because it increases their cure rate.
Where it gets a little muddier is when the chemo would never be curative, but may buy the patient time or control their cancer, keep them in remission.
Jennifer Jindrich went back to the hospital in April and had a scan in May to find out how missing a month of treatment had affected her cancer. She was worried and wanted to bring someone with her, but she had to go alone because of the pandemic. The results were better than she expected. The scan only showed slight tumor growth. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And WPR is committed to covering all aspects of the COVID-19 outbreak. We've got the latest stories and conversations from here on the Ideas Network about the new coronavirus posted on our website. Just visit WPR.org/COVID to learn about the latest news and read those, listen to those related stories. That's WPR.org/COVID. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Facebook groups were designed to let people share their mutual interests without a lot of outside noise. Two researchers say those same features make them well-suited to spread misinformation and online hate. We're talking to the researchers tomorrow about what happens and why you should think about it. That's tomorrow on Central Time. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show. Tomorrow, we're talking about a jump in COVID cases in western Wisconsin. Last week, La Crosse County saw an increase of 41 coronavirus cases in just 2 days. Plus, people may have been exposed to the virus after visiting certain establishments downtown. We talk with an infectious disease specialist about what a peak would look like in that part of our state. That conversation and more here on the Ideas Network tomorrow morning. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then some parents are weighing the risks of sending their children back to daycare. We're talking with a pediatrician and an early childhood specialist about how to keep them safe and how to talk about what's going on. I'm Keeley Boltina. Host Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. This is Central Time, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Thank you.